This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, myself and Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And I have to say, Leslie Ann, your reputation is spreading wide and far now through Life on Planet Porky and some of the salacious revelations you've been making, not just about people you know, but about yourself as well.
Well, they're all running scared now, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I would think so, because, you know, let's face it, there's an old expression about, you know, where the bodies are buried, you know what I mean?
We've known that a long, long time. Ooh. I sometimes think we should go around Fleet Street with a spade and a fork and dig a few up.
Yeah, I sometimes think we should go around Fleet Street and just call in every pub we used to use. Just
Well, go on, let's do that. Yeah. Let's absolutely do that, because while we're still unlocked, because, you know, if they lock us down again, we won't get to do that for a couple of years, probably.
Golly, if they locked us down again, this country's finished. It's half finished already.
Well, let's make that our Christmas present to ourselves.
Definitely.
And we'll go on a bender, a good old-fashioned, all-day-long Fleet Street bender. How about that?
Totally agree. You know, starting maybe at the punch and then the bell and then Cheshire cheese and, I don't know, countless others. Very good. Okay, now then, Ms. Jones, I've been watching Mr. Tom Bauer on the Gogglebox just in the last few minutes. He, of course, is the biographer of Boris Johnson. And extremely successful biographer. You know, he's written biographies on everyone before. We talked about him before, but he was very defensive about Boris Johnson this morning, talking to Piers Morgan. And he was saying he's very hardworking, which shocked everybody who said, no, no, he's a dilettante. But the story that gripped me in the serialisation about his book this week was that, you know, Boris is just, I mean, he's just, his behaviour's just unforgivable. When he's married to Marina, having an affair with another woman in London, they're all in Davos at some, you know, international conference. Boris is the mayor of London. David Cameron is the prime minister. George Osborne is the chancellor. And they're all squabbling, you know, on petty issues of who's the best and who did best at Oxford and who did best at Eton, which George Osborne didn't go to. And then it's revealed in Tom Bauer's book, Boris slipped away early to have a load of horizontal refreshment with a woman he met in Davos on a one-night stand, but she thought she was starting a relationship with the mayor of London and is still furious about it. I mean, this man doesn't seem to have any rules, does he?
Well, hang on. Do I have any sympathy for this woman or these women in general? Mm. You think you're starting a relationship with someone you've just met that night? Well, and you go to bed with them the first night, what do you expect?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I tell you something. I've never really been into one-night stands. I don't wish to, you know, pursue an investigation into your social habits over the decades, Miss Jones. But it's never really turned me on, to be honest, because I just couldn't be bothered. And I always find it very, very difficult extricating myself from that sort of situation the following morning, because I'm a gentleman and I don't like to be a sort of wham-bam, thank you, ma'am type operator. You see what I mean?
Yeah, but you must have done it to know that you find it difficult to extricate yourself.
Well, I have occasionally, but I mean, I tried to keep it down to a minimum. On one occasion, I left my watch and I had to send a Fleet Street mate round to go and get it for me. It was, I tell you what, it was Frank Thorne. Do you remember Frank Thorne?
No, it must be before my time. I'm a mere child, of course.
Yeah, well, of course you are. Yeah, Frank Thorne worked for Sunday newspapers, the Sunday Mirror and then the Sunday People. And we were on a story once in Leeds, I think it was. And we were there for a few days. It was a buy-up story, you know, and he had walking around with a big cheque in his pocket for the Sunday papers. But I, the waitress in the cocktail lounge in the hotel took a real shine to me. And
what, you gave her one?
I'm sorry?
Did you give her one?
I mean, what kind of an expression is that, honestly, Miss Jones? I mean, you know, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, I'm trying to keep it clean. It's a family show, after all. Yeah. Did you give her one?
Well, what happened was she lived in sort of a kind of maisonette nearby, and she said,
Oh, dear.
So we didn't go to my room because it was against rules for members of staff to have sex with the guests in the rooms. You see what I mean? So we went back to her place. And I was astonished when, you know, half an hour into the action, so to speak, I heard the front door open and close, bang. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, have you set me up or something? She said, no, that's just my dad coming in.
Oh, my God. So hang on a minute. Hang on. You pull the waitress in the hotel.
Yeah.
And you immediately go back to her maisonette to give her one.
If you want to put it that crudely, yeah, I mean, a bit of horror.
So there's no getting to know the person here. There's no fine dining and wining, and you know, no seduction process.
No.
You might as well go down some knocking short and pull a hooker.
Oh my God, that's a terrible thing to say.
Well, no, it isn't. It's the same thing.
Goodness gracious me. Anyway, that was the first night, but she was so enamoured by me, she invited me back another night, about two nights later. And that's when I left my watch, and I had to send Frank Thorne around to get my watch. It wasn't a terribly expensive watch. It was the only watch I had in those days, you know. And I have to say, I did feel rather rotten about it all, and I'm not sure I ever had a one-night stand again after that.
Oh, dear. I mean, Boris has obviously had a load of one-night stands, I should think.
But I mean,
does that make him any different from most politicians? They travel from city to city and town to town, and they pick it up as they go along. They're opportunists, aren't they, these people?
Absolutely.
And women are always attracted to that element of power.
Men in power, yeah.
Well, which is how people like John F. Kennedy and Henry Kissinger did so well.
Yeah, golly, we talked about Henry Kissinger before. I mean, what an ugly man. How could any woman want to sort of jump into the sack with him?
Power is the aphrodisiac, of course.
I suppose you're right. Now, Mrs. Jones, we've both been reading a story about Phil Collins, and this is a very complicated story. As I understand it, Phil Collins got divorced from a woman in 2008 to whom he gave £25 million. And she went off and got married to somebody else. Then she got divorced. Then she moved back in with Phil Collins in Miami. And now Phil Collins would like her to go. But now she wants like another $25 million to go, even though they never actually got remarried. But she says, well, we were married in all but name.
Well, he's a very unscrupulous man, I have to say, Phil Collins. He's been married three times.
Yeah.
He's got five kids. He dumped his first wife, Andrea, I can't remember how they pronounced it, for a girl called Jill Tavelman in 1984, who was actually really nice. I knew Jill. And they had Lily.
The blonde lady?
Say again.
Was she the blonde lady?
She is blonde, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had Lily together, who's now an actress, of course.
Yeah.
And then they broke up in about 1994. I think Oriana was on the scene by this time. She was a translator on his tour.
Right.
And kind of did a little more than conjugate the verbs, shall we say.
Oh, I see.
And they got together, eventually they married in 1999, and then they broke up in 2008. They had two sons.
Mm.
She got sick some way down the line. He, by this time, was with an American journalist called Dana.
Right.
He was with her from 2017 till about 2016, and then Oriana got sick.
Yeah.
And while she was ill, Phil moved back in to look after her.
Right.
And they sort of got back together again. They got two boys, and so the family was all reunited, and that was all lovely.
Yes.
And then they're all back down in Phil's house in Miami. Meanwhile, she seems to have sneaked off and married someone else.
Yeah, that's right. She said,
so Phil wants her out of the house. But who is who's in the wrong here?
Yeah, well, I don't know. On that first one, excuse me, was that the famous time when Phil Collins was alleged to have faxed his desire to leave his wife?
He dumped Jill by fax, which was the most hideously humiliating thing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, I don't know. And the other thing is, I saw a picture of Phil Collins alongside this story. My God, he looks a shadow of himself these days. He's very thin, gaunt, he's got a walking stick. He looks like a beaten man to me.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing him probably about 4 years ago now on television. I was in Sheffield. I was promoting my David Bowie book.
Oh.
And I was in a hotel watching, I think it was Graham Norton, late on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
And Phil was on promoting his autobiography, and it's called Not Dead Yet. Right. And I looked at him and I thought, well, you look it, mate. You know, he really didn't look like he had long left.
Yeah.
And that was 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So what I think here is it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. Mm. They can't live with each other. They can't live without. Maybe that extra marriage of hers is not for real.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, we don't know, do we? Because nobody's named the guy. So maybe that's just a vicious rumor. But the brilliant thing is that his first wife, after his autobiography came out, she sued him. Because she said she'd been putting up with rumors all these years about how she was as a woman, a person, a mother, and that his autobiography was the last straw.
Wow.
And she sued the crap out of him.
And did she get money?
Yeah, she did.
And what was her name again?
Andrea.
Andrea. Okay, so which one was the friend of yours?
Jill Tableman, who I knew in Los Angeles.
Oh, I see. Years ago. Three wives, is he?
Three wives altogether, yeah. And Dana, long-standing relationship with Dana.
Not I think everything.
No, American journalist, as I said. You. Keep up, Porky, you're not listening. No,
well, I am. Dana was the, just for those who are way back in the mist of time, Dana won the Eurovision Song Contest, didn't she? An innocent young Irish girl who was a late entrant to the Eurovision Song Contest. All kinds of everything remained me of you.
And then you missed your vacation. Yeah. She was rather sweet, wasn't she?
Yeah, but she only lasted like 5 minutes because, you know, she just sort of came and went, but there you are. Now,
didn't she? She became an ambassador or a member of the European Parliament or something like that.
I think she did. I meant she only lasted 5 minutes in showbiz, but you're right. I think she used it as a platform to go on and serve Ireland in public service. I think you're right. I think she did become like a politician, yeah.
Yeah, she was too nice for show business.
That's right. Anyway, look, we all face such an uncertain future. I feel for the people of Liverpool today. It looks like they're going to be locked down, and Liverpool's such a vibrant city. And you were there, weren't you? Was it this year or last year at the Macca?
Yeah, last year for the Lipper graduation, and also went back again to do research for the Lennon book. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, the thing about Liverpool is it carries. It carries a reputation of being a scally city, if you know what I mean. You know what I mean? That, you know, all Scousers are comedians, all Scousers, you know, are a bit dodgy and wide boys and, you know, scallywags and all that kind of stuff. And that reputation is not deserved these days. I did the Toxteth riots, right, in 1979. And they were the first real riots in this country after Brixton riots had happened a year earlier. But it was terrifying, you know. I mean, it was mob warfare. Police were completely unprepared for it. They didn't have any, didn't even have shields. They just wore their normal clothes and batons and stood in a line whilst people were chucking petrol bombs at them and hijacking concrete mixers and setting fire to them and rolling them down the hill from Toxteth into the town. I mean, it was appalling. And to give Mrs. Thatcher a due, she thought, you know, this sort of social deprivation's got to go. She appointed Michael Heseltine to go out and be sort of, you know, commissar for Liverpool. And he did, to give him his due, turned Liverpool round. They put loads of investment in it. And it's a wonderful, thriving city now. It's obviously got a huge attachment to the Beatles. But the Hard Day's Night Hotel is probably going to have to close down. I mean, it breaks my heart. It's a city of such culture and football. You know, I just don't know what's going to become of it.
You stayed in that hotel, didn't you? I stayed there too.
Yes.
What a dreadful place.
Oh, do you think so?
Oh my God, I didn't get a wink of sleep. I was in a corner room facing the front, right on the edge of Matthew Street.
Yeah.
And there was a busker under my window. I swear he went on all night long singing Beatles songs.
Jolly.
You know, I love Beatles as much as the next man, but really that was too much.
Yeah.
And there's not much there that really, you know, it's not a theme hotel in that you don't really get the Beatles experience. You walk around, there's a few sculptures, a few photographs on the wall, but there's not, you couldn't really call it a theme hotel, I don't think.
Well,
not in the Disney sense.
No, I think you're right. I mean, there's that huge portrait of John Lennon in like the entrance hall, and I've had my picture taken alongside that so many times, but I can never find it, so I always go and take another one, you know. I think it was kind of all right, but I agree with you. The problem is that if you come out of the hotel and turn right into Matthew Street, that's really Beatles Street, isn't it? You can't outdo that, you know. It's got the, you know, the new cavern, and it's got bars named after the Beatles, and it's got the statues and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure what they're trying to compete with, but anyway, look, Oh, dear me. Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but there we are. Talking about Beatles just for a minute, because we always do. I saw Brian Wilson, a legendary Beach Boys singer, songwriter, composer, paid a lovely tribute to John Lennon.
Yeah, he did. And he always has done, really. I think, didn't he say his favourite song is Norwegian Wood?
Norwegian Wood, yeah.
He also said that he wrote Pet Sounds, the album, in response to the Beatles' Rubber Soul.
That's right.
And from it, of course, God Only Knows, which is Paul McCartney's favourite song of all time.
Yes.
And Paul said in response to that, that Pet Sounds led the Beatles to create Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah.
So this was incredible sort of interplay here, them inspiring each other and competing with each other up the charts, which... Mm. I wasn't really into music at that point because I wasn't really, you know, I was little.
Yes,
so I didn't know yet. But that must have been a tremendous experience for music fans.
Oh, incredible. And I think whilst they respected each other, they also took the mickey out of each other a bit, because on the White Album, back in the USSR, that's a takeoff of the Beach Boys song about California girls.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it even sounds like it, doesn't it?
It does. I wish they all could be California. I wish they all could be California. That's that one, obviously. But then, sorry, what are you laughing at?
No, it's very good. It's a wonderful interpretation, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, in response, Beatles, you know, wrote a ridiculous song about back in the USSR, where nobody was allowed to go to the USSR in those days because the Iron Curtain was down across Europe. But I think there's a line that's saying, the Ukraine girls really knock me out. They leave the West behind. I mean, it was such a mickey take, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, a complete send-up of California Girls, of course,
but
a very musical send-up and something that we're still singing today.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, talking about rock stars, what do you know about Huey Lewis?
I love Huey Lewis. I used to do his press at Chrysalis Records years ago. Yeah, we went out, played pool with him. He did a gig and I was a really down-to-earth, lovely guy. We went to the Knightsbridge Sporting Club, but we didn't go to the tables. We went downstairs to the basement and played pool.
Where was this?
In Knightsbridge Sporting Club. It used to be there. It's near the barracks, you know, in Knightsbridge. It's not there anymore. The club closed down.
Oh, dear, what a shame. But he was a down-to-earth sort of guy, was he?
Really approachable and lovely, just completely not up himself, which I have to say most of them are once you get them on your own, you know, away from them having to deliver the act, as it were.
Yeah, sure, sure. So, sorry, did you fall into journalism from PR then, Miss Jones?
No, not exactly. I started off at Capital Radio, the London music station. And I was an assistant to Roger Scott, who's famously the DJ's DJ. He was friendly with a guy called John Pash, who is the art director who created the Rolling Stones mouth logo.
Oh,
you know, the lip and tongue logo.
The big tongue, and red tongue, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, John was at the time art director at Chrysalis Records. And said Roger said he was looking for an assistant. Why didn't you go and have a chat with him? And I got the job as his assistant. And it was while I was at Chrysalis that I started to get involved in a bit of PR as well as working for John Pash.
Nice.
But then Channel 4 kicked off and they were looking for a woman presenter to come along and do a rock magazine show with two of the DJs from Capital, Gary Crowley and Nicky Horn.
Right.
And I got that gig. And so Kelvin McKenzie then bought me as a columnist to The Sun from television. So I did it, Ask About Face, if you like.
See, good. And then the career mushroomed from there, of course.
Yeah.
Flying across the Atlantic on the Concorde at a drop of a hat, yes?
Indeed.
Yes, indeed. Okay, brilliant. Anyway, the reason I brought up Huey Lewis was there was a piece about him in one of the papers recently, which I read with interest. I like Huey Lewis because I saw a spoof that they did on him. They sent a girl to interview him, and she kept getting his first name wrong. There were a lot of Lewises around at the time. You know what I mean?
Well, that wasn't his first name.
No. But she said, "Oh, so Lennox." And he said, "What? Lennox, you know, like..."
Oh, I see.
He said, no, sorry, I'm not Lennox. "Oh, no, of course you're not, sorry." And then she called him, like, you know, Martin or something or whatever. But it was a complete spoof. And four times she got his name wrong, and four times he just corrected her, but he never lost his rag. He was a complete gentleman because his attitude was there was this poor young female reporter in front of him. It was her first job. You know, she told him, I'm very nervous. It's my first job and all this kind of stuff, you know. And he didn't throw a fit and say, why did they send amateurs to interview me or anything like that? He was just so nice and kind to this poor girl. And then, of course, you know, somebody jumped out from the shadows and said, gotcha, or something like that. You know what I mean? But it was nice. But the reason I brought him up to talk to you was, in the interview I read with him, he was offered $5 million to allow one of his songs to be used by Coca-Cola in a promotion. And he turned it down. He said, I didn't want to be commercially driven. He said, you know, it was the quality of the music and I had the band to think about and the fans. They would have thought I'd sold out. Blimey, a week later, Michael Jackson sold out to Pepsi Cola for about $20 million.
Well, he didn't sell out, and I was involved in this at the time, actually.
Interesting.
He was only 25, yeah, and I think he was ill-advised. Michael actually did get $5 million for that deal.
Yeah.
And it was during the filming of the commercial, the pyrotechnics ignited his hair, and he was hospitalized. Mm. He had third-degree burns. It left him dependent on painkillers, which contributed to his early death 24 years later. And people who were close to him at the time said that that experience was what sent him crazy. He was never the same after that.
I've read about that, but I thought that was all like a publicity stunt, you know?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, he probably suffered brain damage from that. If you can imagine, his hair was on fire.
Yeah, sure.
And his brothers were literally stamping on his head on the stage to put the fire out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, amazing.
He got a $1.5 million dollar handout.
Is he? What
was... And he donated that to the hospital who treated him. But he was never the same after that. He was just totally dependent on painkillers. It was a terrible tragedy, actually.
Golly, that's an amazing story, because I was working in America at the time. It was the mid-80s. And you didn't believe anything about Michael Jackson being straightforward, because he used to do things like have people take pictures of him lying in an oxygen chamber to sleep. You know what I mean? You know, like...
A hyperbaric chamber.
Yeah, hyperbaric chamber, that's right, yeah. And it appeared on the front of the National Enquirer, as these things always did. And it was sold as a paparazzi sneak picture of Michael Jackson sleeping. Whereas, in fact, it came out later. It was all a stunt, you know, because everything Michael Jackson did was a stunt.
No, not true. He did actually lie in hyperbaric chambers to replenish his oxygen. He was eccentric.
Yeah.
We know that about him.
Yeah.
He did have a pet chimp called Bubbles.
Bubbles, yeah.
I remember when I was on the Mail and we went to London Zoo and rented a chimp. You could rent a chimp in those days.
Rented a chimp?
We rented a chimp.
How dreadful is that? That poor
We got togged up in sort of dark green London zookeeper type costumes, outfits, uniforms. And we went to the Dorchester where Michael Jackson had the penthouse suite.
Right.
And we get in the lift with the monkey.
Yeah.
And we get all the way up to the penthouse suite and to the door of the suite before we're apprehended by a security guy. And we said, look, we've just come to play with Bubbles. We've brought our own chimp.
That's brilliant. And what happened?
Well, we got kicked out, but it was a good story. It made the front page. It was a good story.
Yeah. The other one I remember of that, by the way, and by the way, I did a similar thing. I think I've told you, I've certainly bored our listeners in the past. I did a similar thing, putting on a doctor's coat to get to Peter Sellers when he was dying after his heart attack. I did that alongside a friend of ours called Mr. Roger Tavener.
Yeah. We've all done the dressing up as nurses thing.
Oh, have you? I didn't know.
Family show.
Exactly, family show, keep it clean. No, what I was going to say was, the other one I remember very distinctly, and it worked, and he got in, was Baz Bamigboy. I can never pronounce Baz's name.
You know, you don't pronounce the G, it's just Bamigboy.
Oh, right, Baz Bamigboy, right? Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, like Danny Boy.
Oh, I like Danny Boy, Buzzy Boy, yeah, Bamigboy, yeah. So Baz Bamigboy dressed up as a, and it was a bit kind of racist, this. He dressed up as a bellboy in a sort of bellboy, American bellboy's uniform with a pill.
Oh, I remember Liz Taylor's birthday party,
exactly,
wasn't it?
Exactly. And he took a silver salver up, a bottle of champagne or something like that, and he actually got in. And she so admired his cheek, she played ball, and the pictures and everything were all over the front and spread of the sun. And I think that was Baz's big moment.
They did use Baz, you know, I'm afraid to say, and this is an awful consideration in this day and age, but he was used as the token black on the Daily Mail.
Well,
and he was put into all kinds of situations, which, thinking back now, actually there was something pretty racist about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I, maybe we couldn't see it at the time, but it was quite obvious, you know, what was going on. But then again, Baz is a very talented writer. You know, he's had great success. He works now for the Daily Mail, obviously. And he would have done it anyway. But, you know, in that situation, in those days, we couldn't suddenly object and say, oh, I think you're using me, you know, or I think I'm being exploited. You got on with it because Fleet Street was such a competitive arena, wasn't it?
Yeah, you could lose your job. I remember a time when they were sitting around in the office deciding which of us young female reporters they were going to send down to Wormwood Scrubs as bait.
Yes.
And somebody said, they wanted to send me. And somebody said, you can't send LA. She'll get eaten alive.
Yeah.
At which point Anne Baraclough went, I'll go. You know, it was, they were questionable things that we were asked to do in those days.
Definitely. What were you supposed to be doing at Wormwood Scrubs?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Get thrown to the lions, I should think.
No, Wormwood Scrubs is a prison. Were you supposed to sort of infiltrate the prison and become a friend of some particular prisoner or something?
I think I was supposed to pose as a legitimate visitor and try and get some story that was going down there at the time. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, but fortunately, you were rescued in time. No, I mean, that was all part of it, wasn't it, in those days?
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Now, what about this amazing admission, I suppose it is, from Elaine Page? I don't know how well you know Elaine Page, but I do know that you know Tim Rice, don't you?
Tim's a good friend of mine.
Exactly. And I read over the weekend that Elaine Page admits I was... she's going on about some other woman who claims to be a pot-smoking marriage wrecker. And she said, I know all about that because I actually was a pot-smoking marriage wrecker. And I think she's referring to a relationship with Tim Rice.
Yeah, she is. It's a bit of an exaggeration. She did smoke marijuana in Hair, which was the groundbreaking Age of Aquarius musical on stage at that time. Yep. And she was in a relationship with Tim for 11 years while he was married to, well, he is still married to his wife.
Yeah.
They've never actually divorced. So she told him to sling his hook in the end. But I think they're still friends.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's an amazing interconnecting world, isn't it, the world of show business?
And
connection I want to mention to you, because we know these people personally, Claudia Winkleman, talking over the weekend. Now, Claudia Winkleman has established a fantastic image, in my view, with a fringe, with the sort of what I'd call panda bear eyes and the rather sort of vacant look on her face, her long hair. She does hair adverts, doesn't she? You know, people love her hair. And she said amazingly in a piece I read recently, she said, I was very lucky that my parents had a happy divorce. Now, that seems a bit incongruous, happy and divorced.
It's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a happy divorce. Why would you divorce otherwise?
Well, precisely. So, but anyway, what she's talking about is, now, the reason we know Claudia Winkleman, or I do, is because her mother, of course, is Eve Pollard, and Eve Pollard was Lady Pollard to Sir Nicholas Lloyd, who was my boss at the Express, and Eve worked on the floor above when she was the editor of the Sunday Express. So whenever there was something going on, like Nick's 50th birthday party at home or something like that, Claudia was always around. And I remember as a, you know, a sort of lovely young woman who, I think she went off to Cambridge University and all that kind of stuff. But talking about happy divorce, they even decided when they split up to live two doors away from each other. I don't think your divorce went quite as smoothly, did it, Leslie? I mean, without intruding on private grief.
No, it was hell. It was absolutely hell. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone. Mm. We used to have an expression, actually. Do you remember Jill Pringle, who worked on the Daily Mirror years ago?
I know of her, but I can't place her. But I'm aware of her name, yeah.
Yeah, showbiz reporter. And the expression was, in those days, you wouldn't wish it on Jill Pringle.
Oh, really?
Which we'll go into another time.
But really very popular then, yeah.
We all love Jill. Of course we do. It was just a joke. But, yeah. I mean, no, divorce is a horrible experience. There are no winners, only lawyers.
Yeah.
And people who think that it's that easy, that you get half the house, you get half the assets. If the other party decides to wind everything down, yeah. stop working, declare themselves bankrupt, you're not going to get anything.
Yeah. No.
And I'm afraid it does just boil down to financial, physical assets.
Yeah.
That is what divorce means. Emotion goes out of the window. You wind up hating each other, and the ones walking away, rubbing their hands, having made another £20,000 for a day's work, are the lawyers.
Yeah. No, I've never been married, so I've never obviously been divorced, but I can imagine the hell that you have to go through, because the thing is, you lose control, don't you, of your life and of your assets because somebody else is trying to steal them, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Completely. And yeah. and your bank statements yeah. are there being pored over by a judge and so on. But in my case, it was even worse because I had this wonderful divorce barrister
yeah.
called Mark Saunders,
yeah.
who my ex-husband ended up attacking him in the court, pinning him up against a wall.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And
that was in
tragically,
the corridor of the court, I assume, not the court.
No, it was in the courtroom itself. And contempt of court should have been brought, of course. But that would have set the case back by about a year.
Yeah, sure.
But sometime after that, Mark Saunders lost his marbles and started shooting people with an air rifle in the square in Chelsea where he lived.
Really?
And was killed by police marksmen. And I've often thought to myself,
Mark Saunders. I remember that case. I remember that case very well.
Yeah, he was my divorce lawyer. And I often think, I wonder if it was my divorce that tipped him over the edge.
God, was that somewhere off the King's Road that happened?
Markham Square, yeah.
Is that where it is? Yeah, God,
yeah, where Felicity Kendall lived at the time.
That's right. Yeah, I remember the story and thinking this guy's gone off his rocker. God, that's a terrible, terrible thing. I'll tell you a marriage breakup that took my breath away as well. I had a mate at the Daily Express. Well, he wasn't really a mate, actually. We didn't get on that well. We were politically opposite, and he was very insular. His name is Danny McGrory, and he was a very good reporter, Danny, and I was a reporter on the Express. We didn't really like each other very much. But he was having a secret affair with another lady reporter from the Daily Express, okay? And it was, you know, completely clandestine because they didn't want to draw attention to themselves. And if they left the office after work, they left separately and then met up in Soho or something like that, you know? And Danny went on to be very successful. He went on to the Times and he became a top foreign correspondent. He spent loads of time in Afghanistan, you know, and Israel and Beirut and all that kind of stuff. And From a romance starting like that, because that's quite romantic, isn't it? You know, you meet somebody in the newsroom and go on, they got married, they had children. And then years later, for some unknown reason, Danny went home and told his wife he'd met somebody else and he wanted to be decent about it. He was moving out. So, and you know, she was completely shocked. There was no sign that this is, you know, the marriage had been on the rocks or anything like that. So he rented a bedsit nearby, right, because he wanted to be close to the home. And he died in his sleep.
What, just like that?
Just like that. Just died in his sleep. And you know.
What, having moved into the bedsit?
Yes, yes. He was only there apparently a couple of nights and he just died. I mean, it's a horrendous story, you know what I mean? 1 minute.
Well, that told him, didn't it?
Well,
I mean, it's almost like divine intervention punishment.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree. It was just shocked everybody, you know, beyond belief. It didn't. Some people didn't even know that he'd left his wife. He died so soon afterwards. And
how old was he?
How old was he? It was
about
years ago, a few years ago.
I think. No, how old was he when he died?
I'm trying to think. I would say early 50s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he had some underlying health condition. You know, sometimes people have these heart murmurs and things, don't they?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but, maybe. But I just wondered whether the extreme change in lifestyle might have just, you know, been such a shock to his system. But anyway, look, we mustn't talk about maudlin problems like that. Do you, are you a fancier of a tipple of Martius Rosé, Miss Jones?
Oh, I did used to love that wine back in the day. Mm. It used to come in those round, sort of flat round bottles, didn't it?
Yeah.
Slightly fizzy.
Yes, that's right.
You had to drink it very cold because it was a little bit sweet,
that's right.
as I recall. But then they brought out a white version of it. It's Portuguese wine.
It's Portuguese wine, yeah. Yeah.
And the Matheus White was a real favourite of mine.
Really? Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I haven't had it for years.
No, not...
They brought it back, have they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I haven't had it for years. But, you know, as usual, one of my journals that deals with food and drink said that it's the big boom drink at the moment now. You know, all the smarts are now getting into Matheus Rosé. And it reminded me, when I, again, was a young reporter on The Express, there was, I don't know why, but the Algarve suddenly became the place to go. You know, you flew to Faro and rented a villa, you know what I mean? And everybody was doing it. Like, literally, half the newsroom at The Express would be in the Algarve in July and August. I don't know why. We all went there and must have known the people who ran the hotels and all that kind of stuff, you know? So, anyway, I got into the Matis Rose in a big way because the only thing decent worth eating in Portugal, which I'm sure you've been to many times, have you?
I have, actually. We went there often, practically every summer when we were children.
Yeah, well, there you go. And the only thing worth eating are sardines, right?
Yeah.
But not the sort of sardines I like. I like my sardines in a tin with a ring pull on it. You pull it out.
Oh, gross.
Right?
Not nice. But, not nice. You'll be eating them with baked beans next.
No, I don't do that. No, I eat them. Well, I eat them on sandwiches. Oh, no, on toast.
Oh, no. Sardines gross.
On toast.
Oh, dear, dear.
On toast. I do. I love sardines on toast. Lovely. But anyway, point of story is the sardines they gave you, I mean, all they did was chop the head off and then put them on your plate. You see what I mean? It was like that, really. And they're full.
What, still wriggling?
Not still wriggling, obviously, because they'd been cooked, you know what I mean? But, I mean, they just chop the head off, chop the tail off, and they cook them, and they give you, like, a huge bowl of sardines. But they've got all the bones still in them. Well, I can't eat fish like that. Do you like fish like that?
No, I don't. I don't like fish that tastes of fish.
I know what you mean.
I'm quite perverse about that. So I like, if I have fish, I like cod.
Yes, I know.
Because it doesn't taste of fish. It's almost sort of like a little meaty flavour to it.
Yes, I know. I know exactly what you mean about sardines. They leave an aftertaste, don't they? I don't know.
Yeah, they do. Anything fishy, no thanks.
But anyway, in order to be able to eat these sardines, and there was no other food worth eating in Portugal. I don't know what you used to eat when you were there, but I couldn't find anything else worth eating.
Steak and chips every night, I think it was.
Yeah, well, maybe. Maybe it was, yeah, but this was like we used to go to all these seafood restaurants because that's what everybody liked except me. But in order to compensate for these dreadful sardines, I would drink, you know, a few gallons of Martis Rosé.
A few gallons. Yeah. Don't hold back, Michael, will you?
No, I wouldn't hold back. Anyway, I went one time with a girl who's my girlfriend called Sue.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
Yeah, well, it was, except that I realised from the moment we landed I'd made a terrible mistake and I didn't really want to be on holiday with her. So I drunk more Matis Rosé to, you know, over the dull pain of that.
To anaesthetise yourself.
Right, yeah.
Did she become better looking the more you drank?
No, not really.
Poor girl.
And I don't know why, I just suddenly decided this was the last person in the world I wanted to be with. I didn't want to sleep in the same bed as her. I didn't want to sleep in the same room as her, let alone the same bed. I don't know why. And it was all my fault, you know, and I felt dreadful about it. But on the third day of the holiday, I couldn't stand it anymore. And so I packed my bags and came home.
Did you tell her?
Only afterwards.
Oh, so you just legged it?
I legged it, yeah.
Oh, no. Did you leave her a note?
Well, the thing is, as I say, there were other people there from The Express. There was another couple, Colin and another couple called John. And so before I went, I just went to see one of them and said, look, I can't stand this anymore. I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't. I'm going home. And they said, what, you can't? What about, you know? And I said, look, I'm sorry. Please just tell her. Not, you know. And anyway.
You actually didn't tell her you were leaving?
No, I didn't. She was on the beach and I don't like beaches. So she wanted to spend all the time on the beach. I don't like beaches. She objected to the amount of Matis Rosé I was drinking, which got me rather upset, you know, because I thought she should have been drinking as much as me because that would have eased the pain. So in the end, I just said, look, I'm going. Please just tell her I'm sorry. Never spoke to her again. That was it.
Did you ever see her again?
No, never.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you're off the hook then.
Well, and she stayed for the rest of the holiday anyway and apparently had quite a nice time, you know, because she was in the group and all that. I don't think she liked me very much. I'm not sure why she even came, but...
Oh, well, she used you just to get there.
Well, not really. She was quite successful. She was a banker, actually. She, you know, like a bank manager or something. And, you know...
Not your type at all, though, that, is it?
But very nice person, and I felt rotten about it for years afterwards, really, but somehow got over the pain, probably with... replacing Matthew's Rosé with Pinot Grigio, I would imagine, or some red wine. I tell you what I find heartbreaking. Do you know a journalist called Melanie Reed?
Yeah. Oh, her column just makes me want to cry. It really does.
I do want to cry, honestly. And I don't want to get maudlin again. We like to lift people's spirits with this podcast. But, I mean, just to refresh the memories of our listeners, Melanie was a very energetic, lively, outgoing, country type of girl, lived in a forest in Scotland, you know, a bit up from Stirling or somewhere like that, I think, riding a horse one day, comes off the horse, suffered exactly the same injury as Superman, Christopher Reeve, broke her neck, and she's now confined to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Even her hands don't really work properly. You know, her fingers are all sort of, you know, bunched up and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I felt so awful for her when it first happened. Then you think over the years you get used to it. But she wrote another column in the latest publication in the Times magazine saying that even now she still goes and sits in front of a mirror and just weeps for her loss. Isn't that shocking?
It's an awful, awful outcome. I don't know how you would deal with that, actually.
I wouldn't. I'd have killed myself. And I'm not being mean or ridiculous or anything like that, but I couldn't have. I've said this to my sisters before. If anything like that ever happens to me, please take me to Beachy Head, and I mean this, and let the brake off the chair and let it roll down the hill. That's the way I want to go.
Yeah, but there are security cameras up there, and then your sister would get done for killing you.
Well, you know, I'd write a letter of authority to her or something like that.
Wouldn't make any difference. She'd still be an accessory to the crime.
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, you know, I'm not into this dignitas thing. You know, I'm flying over to somewhere where you're actually going to end your own life. But I think in that case, I think I'd probably, you know, deliberately drink myself to death or something like that. But I couldn't live like that. And I have such huge admiration for Melanie. I mean, you know, the thing is, she was so active. She used to go out and ride her horse every day and all that. And it's awful, isn't it?
Well, it's like Michael Schumacher, isn't it? Similar kind of scenario.
But
did I tell you, by the way, about the German journalist who came over last week to interview me?
No, please tell me.
Oh, in a similar vein, we were talking about dignitas because he was born in Switzerland and Swiss family and so on, and dignitas came up in conversation.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, no, in Switzerland, dignitas is considered shameful because they charge people money to kill themselves.
Yeah.
He said there's another organization called Exit, which is on the state, and if you decide to end your life for whatever reason, and you have to have a good reason, it's all free and gratis, and it's done through this company called Exit.
Right.
And I said, you seem to know quite a lot about this. And he said, well, my parents did it. They took their own lives together.
God, really?
I was horrified. And I said, what happened? He said, well, my father was really ill. He was only 77. They'd made a pact years ago that if one of them got sick, they would go together. They would both check out at the same time.
Yeah.
And so his mother was only 71.
Was there anything wrong with them? Did they have terminal illnesses or something?
The father did, yeah.
Oh, I see.
But the mother went as well. So the father, just before they did it, gave him a big box of all the diaries he'd kept.
Yeah.
And he said, do with these whatever you will.
Yeah.
So my friend, the journalist, Nicola, he decided to write a novel based on what had happened to his parents. His brother demanded to read the manuscript.
Yeah.
So he gave it to him. The guy, the brother, left it on the kitchen table overnight. His daughter, 12 years old, came downstairs during the night, saw it, took it upstairs and read it. And had a breakdown practically because she read about what her grandparents had done.
Golly, didn't know.
So, you know, the effects of these things are very far reaching. It's not just people deciding to end their lives, but it's how those things affect all the people that are left after you've gone.
Yeah, I know. But I think having a relative who's ailing is even worse. You know what I mean? Because you can just see them slipping away slowly and all that. And I think a sudden exit is probably a better thing. But anyway, on to much, much happier times. Midge's birthday, 67. Wasn't he the co-organiser of Band Aid?
Yeah, he was. So he and Bob Geldof wrote the song together, Do They Know It's Christmas, which Band Aid recorded.
Okay.
That was massive number one in 1984, December.
Yeah.
And then they conceived the idea of the global jukebox together. But by this time, Bob sort of ran away with it and Midge got left behind.
Right.
His band, Ultravox, did perform at Live Aid, but Bob became Saint Bob and Midge sort of faded away, didn't he, really?
Yeah, he did. And you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, Bob made a career out of it, didn't he? He became Sir Bob and internationally, you know, applauded for his work. And Midge sort of went back to music, but then Ultravox just sort of disappeared, didn't they?
They were disappearing anyway at that time. They were another chrysalis band. Mm. And we used to dread it when they came in, actually, because they were so pompous and up themselves. Whereas Midge was just a kid from a Glasgow tenement. He was very down to earth, right. Very approachable. He had a sense of humour.
Yeah.
The other guys in the band didn't have a sense of humour. There were, what was there, Billy, Chris and Warren, who was the drummer.
Yeah.
They were very serious. And their career was kind of dwindling at that time.
Right.
I don't think very many people even remember Ultravox hits. Do they?
No, I don't. I couldn't name one, honestly.
But, Vienna?
Oh, Vienna. Oh, yeah, Vienna. Yeah, but I couldn't hum it to you. What's it sound like?
It's got that crescendo of a chorus. It's the song's not really about anything.
Right.
But every few minutes it goes, oh, Vienna.
Oh,
you know,
Vienna, yeah. Well,
that one, yeah, yeah. Dancing with Tears in My Eyes. That was their other big one.
No, I'm seeing it.
But Mitch did have a career as a solo artist. The song that we all said, that's an instant number one when we heard it the first time, If I Was. But it's always wound me up because of the bad grammar.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, hang on. We've spoken about this before, and you said most lyrics of most songs don't make any sense anyway.
Well, they make sense sometimes, but they are poorly constructed a lot of the time. But If I Was clearly should be If I Were.
If I Were, yeah. Yeah. What's that? Was there a song? I know what you mean. They change the tenses just to make it rhyme, don't they, with something?
There was a song, If I Were a Carpenter and You Were a Lady.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
Oh, go on then.
Proposal, Miss Jones.
That wasn't an invitation, I know.
Exactly. It's in my repertoire. Yeah, and there's another one, and da 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 da. I probably would da 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 da. Anyway, I don't know. Listen,
don't remember that one.
Just finish on you telling our audience what on earth's going on between Rod and Elton, because apparently Elton has offered the old olive branch to Rod because they've started to fall out in the last 2 or 3 years. Rod accused by Elton of having a go at him about his final tour, his world tour and all that kind of stuff, and getting upset because when Rod invited Elton and his boys over to play football on his full-size football pitch, he never got a response. I mean, they shouldn't.
Oh, dear. These two old queens, I mean, Sharon and Phyllis, as they're otherwise known, you know, they've known each other since year dot. They've been close friends forever. I think it's only a spat. Rod was a bit outspoken and compared Elton's film Rocket Man to Bohemian Rhapsody and said that it didn't measure up. You know, and then his autobiography, I think Rod poked fun at it and Elton took it seriously. Elton takes a lot of things seriously these days, and I can't help thinking that it has something to do with his husband, David Furnish.
Yeah.
There, I've put it out there.
Well, I think you may well be right, because you're absolutely right. All of a sudden, you get a sort of an inkling that he's very, very prickly, don't you? You know, about almost every issue that he deals with and all that. So maybe it's because he's a father, he's very protective towards his children or something, you know, or whatever. But yeah, I'm sure that Mr. Furnish will have an influence on his life in many different ways.
Elton takes everything far too seriously nowadays.
Yeah.
He used to be a bundle of fun.
Yeah. Well,
it's a shame.
He went through a lot of addictions and things, though, didn't he? So,
yeah, he did.
Yeah.
You know, but he's rehabilitated. He's got, as you say, a lovely family now, two gorgeous little boys. I think there's a lot of guilt in Elton. I mean, the way his relationship with his mother panned out.
Oh, yeah, I know. That
was not happy, was it? And I thought the film was disgraceful in its representation of his relationship with her.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know. But I'll take your word for it, Miss Jones. Right, OK, that's it for Planet Porky today. Thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you also for all the responses. We do get an awful lot of feedback, Miss Jones, don't we? And most of it.
Yeah, I love the interaction on Twitter. Keep it coming.
Yes, please do. Okay, folks, until next time, this is Planet Porky signing off. And Miss Jones, have a great week.
Ciao for now.
We went back to her place and I was astonished when, you know, half an hour into the action, so to speak, I heard the front door open and close, bang. And I thought, what's going on here? Yeah, have you set me up or something? She said, no, that's just my dad coming in.
Oh, my God. So hang on a minute. Hang on. You pull the waitress in the hotel.
Yeah.
And you immediately go back to her maisonette to give her one.
if you want to put it that crudely, yeah, I mean, with a horrible.
So there's no getting to know the person here. There's no fine dining and wining, and you know, no seduction process.
No.
You might as well go down some knocking short and pull a hooker.
Oh my God, that's a terrible thing to say.
Well, no, it isn't. It's the same thing.
Goodness gracious me. I went one time with a girl who's my girlfriend called Sue.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
Yeah, well, it was, except that I realised from the moment we landed I'd made a terrible mistake and I didn't really want to be on holiday with her. So I drank more Matthias Rosé to, you know, over the dull pain of that.
To anaesthetise yourself.
Right, yeah.
Did she become better looking the more you drank?
No, not really.
Poor girl.
And I don't know why, I just suddenly decided this was the last person in the world I wanted to be with. I didn't want to sleep in the same bed as her. I didn't want to sleep in the same room as her, let alone the same bed. I don't know why.
We get in the lift with the monkey.
Yeah.
And we get all the way up to the penthouse suite and to the door of the suite before we're apprehended by a security guy. And we said, look, we've just come to play with Bubbles. We've brought our own chimp.